Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, a new report from the AARP Fraud Watch Network reveals how some common digital habits that we're all guilty of could leave us vulnerable, and emphasizes the importance of the newly formed National Elder Fraud Coordination Center. We'll learn more. Also this morning in our Throwback Thursday segment, nearly everyone with a job will lose a job at one time or another, but that helpless feeling doesn't mean you are helpless. Noted workplace attorney Stephen Mitchell Sack explains what to do if and when you get fired. And happening around town, the students of Heritage Christian School will join us to preview this weekend's spring play. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, April 24th, 2025. Big news yesterday. And we were talking a little bit about this. U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced plans to remove 8 synthetic food dyes from American products by the end of next year. These are food dyes that are petroleum-based, actually. Nobody wants to eat petroleum. And so these petroleum-based food dyes are going to be stripped from U.S. foods by the end of next year. Red 3, red 40, blue 1, blue 2, yellow 5, yellow 6, and green 3. They are used in all kinds of different products, candies, cereals, some sodas. But they have been linked to hyperactivity in children and allergic reactions. So this I thought was kind of interesting, and the reason I mentioned this on the Newswire, they put together a list of some of the products that will have to be changed in their formulations because they use these dyes. Candies like Jolly Ranchers, Skittles, M&M's, Trix, let's see here, snacks like Flamin' Hot Cheetos, and drinks like Sunny D, just to name a few. And how many of those products do you regularly consume? But they have these dyes in them, and so they're going to have to change their formulas. Now, of course, the companies that make all of these products that rely on these dyes in their formulations are not happy about this, but most of these have been prohibited in other countries for quite some time. Now, some of these products are not necessarily sold overseas, or they're not quite the same, but you know they do have a template to work with because other countries have previously outlawed these dyes, and there has been a movement a long time to do this. But he's not stopping there. RFK Jr. has said he wants to get all of the chemicals out of our food to the extent that it is possible within the next couple of years. So this is just the first. There may be more of these new regulations regarding food dyes, food additives, and so on and so forth. So stay tuned. Big story that generated a lot of headlines yesterday. I thought this was kind of interesting. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, as I'm perusing the Newswire this morning, apparently historians have uncovered a new letter written by William Shakespeare to his wife, Anne Hathaway, that dates all the way back to the 17th century, which suggests that the pair had a much better relationship than was previously believed. Many scholars believe that Shakespeare and his wife did not actually lived together, that he lived in London. She was back home in her hometown of Stratford, and they had limited contact. They were married, but they had limited contact with each other. But this letter, which was found in the binding of a book in the library at the Hereford Cathedral. Anyway, it suggests that the two did, in fact, live together. The communication is regarding giving money to an orphan boy. And I don't know what the content of the letter is. It just alludes to the general subject of the letter about giving money to an orphan boy, but it seems to indicate that the pair did in fact live together. And Professor Matthew Stegall, who is a Shakespeare historian, says for biographers of the bard who favor the narrative of the disastrous marriage, this document is going to be a problem because it blows the lid off the idea that the marriage was strained or just in name only. But apparently they were much closer than... Anyway, I just thought it was interesting. I know it doesn't necessarily alter your day or alter your world, doesn't rock your world or anything like that, but it is interesting nonetheless. I just thought that was wild. All of these things that we think we have known for decades thrown out the window because of the discovery of this one letter in this cathedral. Kind of randomly, I guess. Taylor Swift has been dethroned as the youngest self-made woman billionaire in the world. For the longest time, she was the youngest self-made woman billionaire. She is no longer. Forbes first reported her billionaire status in 2023, and now the title of youngest self-made woman billionaire in the world belongs to 30-year-old Lucy Guo. Lucy Guo. I don't know. I suppose if she's a billionaire, maybe I should learn how to pronounce her name. She is the co-founder of Scale AI. So Forbes estimates her net worth at $1.25 billion. And so she is the youngest self-made woman billionaire, now dethroning Taylor Swift for that title. She is one of only six self-made women billionaires on the planet who are under 40 years old. And of those six, two of them are big-name music artists, Taylor Swift and Rihanna. But this woman who is a pioneer in the AI space apparently is the youngest now. So, interesting. I don't know. And a couple of other interesting items here among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Speaking of AI, this is the latest thing now. A popular generative AI filter is allowing people to transform their pets into people. Using artificial intelligence, you could, for example, turn an Australian cattle dog into a forlorn man with a brown sweater. Somebody did this. That was one of the generative AI. A Turkish van cat morphed into a sophisticated young lady. A fluffy Bichon Frise came out as a smiling grandpa with glasses. So this is the big thing, this new AI filter, which allows you to transform your pet into people. These photo generators that are now popular on TikTok, they say, are showing you what your best friend would look like if he or she was a human companion. So make of that what you will. I don't know. Do I want to know what my dog or my cat would look like as a human? Apparently people do. And think about this. I saw this on the Business Wire, and this is definitely something that made me go, this morning. It definitely fits into that most interesting category, this item, because it is spring and home buying season and all of that. About a third of homebuyers, are looking for a space where they can live with multiple generations of their family. This is according to a new survey by Veterans United Home Loans. They asked 900 potential homebuyers, and 29% say they are looking for a space where they can live with multiple generations of their family because of aging parents who need care. 21% will do it simply to help cover the costs, because owning a home is so much more expensive now than it used to be, that they need to basically live in a multi-generational home to be able to afford it. 27% say they get help from older generations so they can either live in a certain area or spend part of the year together. Maybe they don't live together full-time, but part of the year together. And but one-third, about a third of homeowners looking for a space in their new home where they can live with multiple generations of the family. Last year, that number was 17%. That is a huge jump year over year from last year to this, the number of people who are looking for multi-generational homes. In other societies, this has been pretty standard for a long time. And in many other cultures, multi-generational households are quite common. But in this country, it has not been the case, but between cost and convenience, their aging baby boomer population, more and more multi-generational households are popping up. And it seems like this year, there is a huge influx in the number of people who are looking to buy multi-generational friendly homes, just from last year, just compared to last year. Big jump of that. Interesting stuff. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories. There you go, to get your Thursday morning started here.
This is ONN. I'm Jay Fox on the Ohio News Network. In Southwest Ohio, 23-year-old DeAndre Poole pled guilty to murder yesterday in a Clark County courtroom. The Springfield News Sun reports that Poole will serve 15 years to life in prison at the penitentiary in Orient for the December stabbing murder of Darren Pollock. Court records show Pollock stole Poole's backpack and a chase ensued, with police finding Pollock in the grass near the loading dock of a Meijer store with a stab wound to the chest. He was pronounced dead at Mercy Health Springfield, where it was determined he died of a knife wound to the heart. West of Cleveland, a former Lorain police lieutenant who accused his own department of discrimination and retaliation has been fired. Peter Fleischer of ONN affiliate WKYC-TV reports.
A newly released investigation walks through Lorain police lieutenant Corey Middlebrooks' concerns about Chief Jim McCann. Middlebrooks lodging complaints of potential discrimination, retaliation, and unprofessional behavior. Records show Middlebrooks was disciplined several times for a failure to plan and coordinate police personnel before he brought up issues about leadership. Middlebrooks was terminated April 17th.
The Cleveland Cavaliers have a two-game lead in the best-of-seven series versus the Miami Heat after winning 121-112 yesterday. Game 3 is in Miami Saturday at 1 p.m. For the Ohio News Network, I'm Jay Fox.
So a new report from the AARP Fraud Watch Network examines how our everyday online habits could be putting us at risk, because as fraud continues to evolve, some common digital behaviors could leave you vulnerable. Kathy Stokes is with us once again. She is Director of Fraud Prevention Programs for the AARP Fraud Watch Network. And Kathy, I'm looking at some of the numbers from this report. They are indeed alarming. Tell us about this report and the current state of fraud in the United States.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I think the most eye-opening thing that we learned in this survey is that 41% of us have experienced a fraud loss, monetary or identity fraud.
Wow.
And that's huge, right?
Yeah, four in 10
people.
Yeah, 2 in 5.
Yeah. So we have to sort of understand that this is the number one crime in this country, and we have to be doing a lot more than what we're doing to protect consumers and start to put an end to some of this activity.
And to be clear, when we say that because fraud continues to evolve, some common behaviors could leave you vulnerable, what that means is that some of the behaviors that probably were not unsafe in the past now are.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris. We have to evolve with the criminals. And, you know, one of the big areas, and this one has been a problem for a long time, but still kind of vexes us, and that's using unique and strong passwords for each of our online accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend not to do it because it's not easy to remember all of them, or we think we have to write them down and then there's a risk for somebody seeing them. I think we really need to move toward adopting a password manager, do a little bit of research online, see what might work for you. But that is an important protection while we're still in the world of requiring passwords. I think they're going to be a has-been soon enough.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring that up because I know I resisted using a password manager for the longest time, thinking that maybe they weren't secure. And if someone hacks into my password manager, would they have all of my passwords?
I think the risk is much higher if you're not using the strong and unique passwords that are provided. And I do remember, I think, a hack that happened to a password manager, but none of the data was actually hacked into.
Mm. Interesting. You know, along those same lines, a lot of websites and various platforms have gone to what they call two-factor or multi-factor authentication. This is another thing that many people will skip those steps. And again, you're kind of opening yourself up to the possibility of fraud.
You know, we're used to fast, we're used to convenient, but if we understand that an extra level of friction is for protecting us, protecting our accounts and our money, then maybe we can accept that, you know, taking that moment to set up multi-factor authentication so that in addition to your username and password, you're also having to put in a piece of information that only you have that gets sent to you by text or voicemail typically. That's an extra level that we should all accept as being important for our own protection.
Yeah. So again, time to sort of reevaluate how secure we are being with all of those online platforms. And even things as simple as downloading apps or playing those online quizzes or, you know, those types of things that we see on social media, these also can pose real threats.
Yeah, when we are downloading apps, we really need to go to the safest place to do that, and that's the App Store on your device.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at apps that are free and downloadable on social media, and it's like, oh, it might be fun, well, it also might be downloading malicious software onto your device where they're capturing your usernames and logins and trying to access all of your accounts, including those that are financial. So it's really a risk. And, you know, you look at the quizzes, it's fun, but it actually might be harvesting information that can be used to, I don't know, guess your passwords.
Yeah.
or even to be used to target you specifically for a scam. The more they know about us, the greater the likelihood is they can have a scam that works on us.
Yeah, that is a good point. It may not be it may be a means to an end rather than the end itself, the end game itself.
Right.
In those in those cases, interesting stuff. So I can hear some people asking, is it just too dangerous anymore to go online at all?
You know, I think that we there's a message of empowerment in here, and that is that there are things we can do to protect ourselves, you know, as well as we can on social media, online, not responding to emails and text messages that have links or that put you into a heightened emotion. It's really sad, and we always know this about phones, right? But it's really sad that we cannot trust incoming communication now.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, we should demand change, that we can begin to, again, trust that a text that's coming from your bank is actually from your bank and not an impersonator.
You know, one of the things that you make the point with respect to this survey, this report, is that these findings show that anyone can be a victim of fraud. And that's important because I think previously maybe some of us have thought that for some reason we are immune somehow.
Yeah, we've had this sort of malaise because we figure, yeah, it happens to other people, but it will never happen to me. And the sad thing about fraud being so ubiquitous now is that we're all at risk. But the good thing is that now we know, and there are things that we can do. And we know one of those things, Chris, is talking. you know, if your folks are listening today and they're learning something that they didn't know before to protect themselves, talk about it. Call your mom, call your dad, you know, hey, you know, I heard about this new scam. You know, we have to have a conversation because the more we know about what's happening out there, the better protected we are.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you don't know about it, chances are good others don't know about it, so you can help spread the word in a positive way. Yep. You know, I have heard it said that seniors are not the most frequently targeted victims in terms of raw numbers, but when they are victimized, they tend to lose more to these scams. And to that end, there is a new effort to go after elder fraud, which AARP is playing a role in this. Tell us about this National Elder Fraud Coordination Center.
Well, thank you so much for asking me about that. Yeah, this is a first-of-its-kind initiative where it'll bring the public and private sector together to share fraud intelligence, to be able to look at existing elder fraud cases through an organized crime lens so that that one, you know, the one Greensboro $10,000 grandparent scam gets connected with all of the other ones in between, and all of a sudden, it's not a $10,000 case, it's a $1 million case, and you can actually see that law enforcement will want to work those cases and arrest and convict, and it begins to disrupt the fraud business model, which is simply not being disrupted right now.
Yeah, that is a terrific idea because, as we know, these are never one-off, and because of the nature of the online universe, they can happen anywhere. These instances in Ohio and California and Florida and the Carolinas or whatever all might be connected to this same enterprise. It's great stuff. Where do we get more information?
Well, on the National Elder Fraud Coordination Center, you can go to fightelderfraud.org to learn more about it. And for more information on how to protect yourself from fraud and scams, go to aarp.org/fraudwatchnetwork.
Kathy Stokes, again, Director of Fraud Prevention Programs for the AARP Fraud Watch Network, with us this morning. Kathy, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
And now our Throwback Thursday segment this morning. You know, with all of the economic uncertainty that we have right now, certainly has been very much in the news, the labor market has been pretty robust, at least for now. But the longer this uncertainty lingers, the more that may impact jobs. And that means we could see more companies, you know, downsizing, that kind of thing. It's something that just about everybody is, unless you have been in business for yourself, everyone who works for a living runs the risk of getting fired at some time or another. Every year, more than 20 million U.S. workers lose a job for one reason or another. And if it has ever happened to you, you know how helpless you can feel when it happens. But that doesn't mean you are helpless. Nationally known workplace attorney Stephen Mitchell Sack is author of the book Fired, what he calls a first aid kit for surviving a firing. And back in September of 2022, we spoke to him about it. It is today's Throwback Thursday. Stephen, what is the first thing that you advise people to do if and when they do get that dreaded pink slip?
What I suggest people do is figure out why they were fired. Most of the time, we're presuming that you're not fired for punching someone out or stealing or, you know, drinking on the job.
Right.
But it's a layoff, downsizing, restructuring. It's something that, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, so to speak. That's the first thing. And then if that happened to you, you have to question the firing, certainly the timing of it, and you must go back in and, if they make you an offer of severance, always negotiate a better deal.
So you're dealing with terminations that may not necessarily be wrongful, not a legal recourse. I mean, sometimes there will be wrongful termination, and that's a whole different set of issues, right?
Correct. Even if you're not illegally fired, you might have been unfairly fired. Let's say you're terminated right before you're expecting a bonus, or you did the legwork on a large commission and the customer's about to pay the $1 million for the order that you worked so hard to procure, and they fire you right before the customer finalizes the deal, or you're terminated right before an expected financial benefit like stock options that are about to vest or a pension or profit sharing plan. In those and many more circumstances, the firing itself may have been legal, but the timing is wrong, and you really need to get the fruits of your labors, the benefit of what you did for them. And in Fired, I lay out the ways in which people can ask for more money, what to say, what to do, and I think it's very clear that if they go in there and ask for it, the odds are good that they'll get a better package.
I would imagine it's fairly common for someone to come back with, you know, you're probably right, but I get this reputation that will dog me in the future. Will I win the battle and lose the war?
It's a very possible, idea. I don't find that at all in the 15,000 people that I've served. Not one person has ever said to me, you know, by you asking for it, you screwed up my reputation. Never.
One of the other things that I wanted to ask about, and it kind of speaks to the phenomenon we're seeing of quiet firings, where employers don't come out and actually let someone go, but they will do things like pass you over for a promotion or deliberately assign you to an undesirable project or cancel coaching sessions or evaluations. It's all in an effort to force someone to quit. Is that legal?
It is. Never leave a job. That's for sure. I mean, anyone who resigns from a job, I think is making a big mistake. Unless you have a new job lined up.
Right.
The better way to do it is go to the company and say, look, it's clear that you're not happy with me. I don't know why. I'm doing a great job. But if you don't think so, what I think we should do is just work out an amicable severance package and do it that way. Because, listen, if you resign from a job, you're waiving unemployment benefit, like we said before, if you're close to an expected commission or a bonus or stock, you're waiving that. So you don't want to give the company the ability to get you out of there and pay you nothing.
Would it be fair to say that a significant number of firings, either that turn out to be wrongful or just unfair, could maybe be prevented if some of the underlying issues have been communicated properly from the beginning?
Very much so. And that's why one of the strategies I tell everybody is if you're working for a company and all of a sudden you get a negative performance review or a performance improvement plan, and you believe it's subjectively unfair or factually incorrect, don't just sign that you received it and let it go. You have to write a simple, respectful rebuttal so that you preserve your rights and you show them you didn't agree to that. In another situation, let's say you've been working at a company and you were hired by Jim Smith, who has always been your loyal supporter, giving you great reviews, and then Jim quit or was terminated, and then Mary Jones comes in and she's your supervisor, and all of a sudden you start clashing and you get a negative review after 10 years, you know. Well, a leopard doesn't change his or her spots. I think that that's pretty clear that you're just being forced to get out of there, and then you should hire a lawyer like myself to speak to them, especially if you've been there a long time, and work out an amicable, fair package. Shoot for 4 weeks per year of severance. Now, you may have been offered 1 week per year, but if you ask for 4 weeks and they come back with 2 weeks per year, guess what? You just doubled the offer.
Right.
And get them to pay for your medical premiums under COBRA. You know, a lot of companies know that when you're out of work, how are you going to pay the $2,000 a month COBRA premium? The company will very often throw in a couple of months of paid COBRA just to do the right thing by you, but you won't get it unless you ask for it.
You know, it strikes me that the information in this book, not only helpful for anyone who has been fired or is at risk of being fired, but also a business owner or a manager who obviously wants to avoid the headache of legal action from a wrongfully or unfairly terminated employee.
Well, that's essential for HR people and employers to know what rights employees have, how employees are going to react, and maybe it'll shed some light for an employer on how to do the right thing. So it's an important time in a person's life. It's one in which I felt that people need to know their rights, know how to assert themselves, know how to fight back. And that's why I was so thrilled to write this book, because it's my legacy. You know, I've been doing this for 42 years. And my strategy is a tried and true. Very few lawyers really practice this very, very unique specialty of labor and employment law. And I just felt, you know what? I wanted to do something and give something back to the American public.
Again, our conversation with nationally known workplace attorney Stephen Mitchell Sack about his book, Fired, A First Aid Kit for Surviving a Firing, from back in September of 2022. Today's Throwback Thursday. We have a link for if you want to check the book out. We've got the book linked up at our webpage. You can go to goodmornings.net to learn more about it.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Apparently, there is video of this. Someone in Austin, Texas is giving a new, much more literal meaning to the phrase hanging out. As reported by local news outlets there in Austin, Texas, a very daring individual was spotted hanging from a giant crane in the downtown area of Austin, Texas. Hanging from a giant crane. According to the Austin Police Department, which is investigating the incident, the crane rider eventually climbed down the structure and into a high-rise building. This individual, who was just hanging from the crane, remains unidentified. But apparently is there video of this? There are photos of this? Who would do something like this? How bored would you have to be to say, I'm going to dangle from a crane on a high-rise building? That sounds like a fun way to spend an afternoon. How bored do you have to be? Just hanging out. Let's see. Elsewhere in the broken news, Dateline Chino, California, police are investigating after a naked man was shot during a home intrusion. Home invasion there in Chino, California. The suspect, this happened late Tuesday morning. Suspect was trying to break into a home, apparently naked. And the resident of the home opened fire after he tried to enter the residence through a front window. The suspect was shot multiple times in his lower extremities, it says here. Where was he aiming? His lower extremities is how they put it there. He remains hospitalized in stable condition. Investigators believe the suspect was under the influence of some sort of intoxicating substance at the time. Alcohol, drugs, whatever. He was naked trying to break into somebody's home. And he picked the wrong home to break into, apparently. Weird. this is from Laredo, Texas. Border town of Laredo, Texas. An illegal immigrant from Mexico will be spending a couple of years in federal prison before he is deported. That's because Guillermo Osto Navarrete was working as a smuggler in the town of Laredo. He was coming across the border. He's an illegal immigrant. There was a chase last year where he slammed into the side of a state police cruiser. And after the crash, he punched the agent who was trying to make sure he was okay. Crashed into the side of a state police cruiser, which would be bad enough. But then, you know, the officer wants to make sure he's okay because, you know, that's what they do. Even if they're going to arrest you, they want to make sure you're okay, right? And he beat up the Border Patrol agent. At the hearing, the judge said it was a miracle that he did not get someone killed. He is not going to spend 2 years in federal prison and then be deported. So, not the brightest bulb in the pack, you know? It's okay. Here's an interesting Easter story out of Florida. This is from Jacksonville, where a man by the name of Mike Dragic, known as the Blue Collar Brawler, He got a call on Easter Sunday, had to leave his own family's Easter dinner in order to wrangle an alligator. That's what he does for a living. And, you know, he has to do it even on the holiday. A woman on from Jacksonville reported a gator in her yard. And so Mr. Dragic was called in. He showed up at the woman's home wearing just a tank top and shorts, not even a pair of shoes, and wrangled the alligator, contained the gator by trapping it in a trash can. No animals or people were injured. Can you imagine being so confident in your skills to wrangle alligators that you show up in a tank top and shorts and not even shoes and say, "Where's the gator?" So, on Easter Sunday. When duty calls, there you go. This is a great story out of New Jersey where a cop in the Garden State went up above and beyond when a door dasher had car trouble. The delivery driver was supposed to be taking a Chick-fil-A order to a hungry customer over the weekend. When their vehicle broke down, Officer Mike McInerney Jr., decided to complete the order himself while helping the gig worker. He came across him. He was on the side of the highway. He was broken down. Cop pulls over, makes sure that he's okay. "Is there anything I can do for you?" "Yeah, you can deliver this order to this person who ordered Chick-fil-A." Officer McInerney said, "Nobody wants cold Chick-fil-A." So he was happy to complete the delivery of the order. Can you imagine? Cop showing up at your door. "Did you order Chick-fil-A?" Now that is dedication right there. And finally, in the broken news this morning, this is amazing science. And apparently, according to new research by scientists in West Africa, chimpanzees enjoy a good happy hour, just like humans do. New video, they captured video of wild chimps enjoying fermented breadfruit together. These chimps would gather together and enjoy this fermented breadfruit. It is the first time the shared behavior has been documented on film. Researchers suggest using the alcohol for social bonding could explain why humans evolved the ability to metabolize alcohol from that evolution from primates. And that's why we enjoy happy hour. I don't know if it's scientifically sound. I'm not a scientist, but I'll go with it. It's nature. Findings published earlier this week in the journal Current Biology. Are you going out for happy hour drinks with your friends after work? You can just say, "Hey, it's science. It's evolution. This is what we do." We're programmed to enjoy happy hour just like the gyms do. There you go. Some of the odd and unusual items here. Today's broken news report. With that, we now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Ever thought about joining the Findlay Rotary Club?
I'm Scott Holman, president of Resolute Wealth Advisor, and I'm proud to be a Findlay Rotarian where collectively we rely on the strengths of each member to impact our club's vision of uniting local leaders to influence positive change.
Our ability to influence positive change locally and around the world grows through membership in the Findlay Rotary Club. To learn more about how you can help make a difference, go to findlayrotary.org.
This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. The average parent says that their child, in that first year of their child's life, they experience 50 milestones, nearly 50 milestones in that first year. And a new Talker research survey of 2,000 parents of babies, of young children between 9 months and 2 years of age, they found that the most highly anticipated milestone of that first year of their baby's life baby's first steps. Two-thirds, 66%, said that is the one that they are most impatient for in that first year. Baby to take his or her first steps, 66%. 62% said baby's first words are the most highly anticipated milestone. 60% said baby's first laugh, which is always sweet. And 53% go all the way to baby's first birthday is the most anticipated milestone of that first year of their baby's life, that first birthday. It's kind of interesting. 78% of those in the survey say even though they know to expect all of those milestones, they still, when they happen, come completely out of the blue. 78% say they just come right out of the blue. And we are into documenting all of these milestones of our kids. On average, we take 1,000 photos a year, those first 2 years. 2,000 photos in those first 2 years, photos and videos of their little ones on their camera roll is what most parents have. The average parent has 2,000. Basically, three photos or videos every single day in their first 2 year, in those first 2 years. And when asked, the folks in the survey, when they asked what was the most surprising milestone that pulled on your heartstrings in that first year, a couple of responses stood out. One said, when my baby wrapped his arms around and hugged his older sister for the first time. That was that really gets you in the feels. And another said, I was not expecting to be so emotional over transitioning to larger size clothing. It's been bittersweet to watch my baby grow every time you have to put him in larger clothes. I thought that was kind of interesting. And we know that these milestones are coming. We're not always really prepared. 89%, according to the survey, 89% of parents feel some level of preparedness, but only 45% feel very knowledgeable when it comes to their child's changing needs through that first year. We have a whole studio full of folks. The students of Heritage Christian School are with us now to preview this weekend's spring play. It is called A Little Princess, and it happens Friday and Saturday, tomorrow and Saturday. And so I'm going to have you go around the room and introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about the character that you play in the play here. So we'll just start right on this end, kind of step up here and tell us who you are and what your character is all about here.
So my name is Catherine Krenzer, and I play Lavinia. Mm-hmm. And so she is the oldest student in the school.
Okay.
And so Sarah Crew, who's like the main character when she comes in, I don't like her at all. Ah. So I'm very mean towards her. Like, I'm the popular student. I kind of run the place. And so now I have competition. And so I kind of am trying to, like, intimidate her and trying to make sure that she doesn't take my position as, you know, ruling over.
Very good. And you are?
Hi, my name is Anna Mangum, and I play the role of Miss Minchin. I am basically the principal of the school. I'm very self-centered. I want everybody to just do what I say. I'm very controlling. I guess when Sarah comes, her dad is very rich, and so I'm hoping I can get a lot of money out of that. So, yeah, that's basically my character.
Okay. And you are?
My name is Felucci Beausoleil. I play Miss Amelia in the play. I am the sister to the main antagonist in the play, which is Anna.
Yeah.
And I'm just a lighthearted teacher who wants what's best for the school.
Okay. You are?
My name is Hunter Kelly. I am playing the character of Ramdas. He is a servant to Pendleton, who is a very wealthy but older man. I'm a bit wiser. I don't really talk that much, but when I do talk, it's something that I should be paid attention to.
Mm.
I also have some interaction with the school as well, which is very important to the play.
Okay. And you are?
My name is Claire Teo, and I play Becky, who is a servant girl, and she eventually becomes Sarah's best friend after they become servant girls together in the attic after Sarah gets in trouble for a few stuff things. And then eventually everything works out in the end with the characters.
Yeah. Basically. Okay. And?
My name is Carolyn Leskowitz. I play Sarah Crew. She is the protagonist of the story. She starts off very wealthy, very close to her dad. And then she, because of England going to war, she has to go to the school for girls. And then she goes through a lot of changes. She has a lot of, her wealth is taken away, and she just continues to have a lot of a good attitude through it all. And that's really the main message of the play.
Talk a little bit about the overarching storyline here, and you were all talking a little bit about your characters in this play. It sounds like this is set many years ago. This is not a modern.
It's in World War II.
World War II era. So talk a little bit about the synopsis. Give us a brief synopsis of the story. Can you talk a little bit about the?
So it's it starts off in India, actually, where where Sarah and her father live there. And then when England goes off to war, her dad is a captain in the army. And so he is called to duty, and he obviously can't take her with her. So she goes to New York. And then he dies, or he's lost in action. And so then all of her wealth is taken away. She's alone in the world. She has no family. And she's forced to work as a servant girl, and then she continues to act like a princess and have a good attitude through it all, and then everything works out in the end for everybody. Mm,
very, very interesting. How long have you been working on this? When did you do the casting and all of that?
It was around March. I think it was the 13th. Not too sure.
Okay, so this has come together in a fairly short amount of time. So the show is tomorrow and Saturday, and give us all of the details on this because there's like a dinner on Friday in conjunction with this.
Yes, it's.
Everything, so.
Yes, it's the patron dinner where people can come and eat dinner
Before the show.
Before the show, if they call ahead of time.
Okay.
And there's a certain criteria for that.
How do folks get tickets for the show?
So for going to the show, you can just call the number that's on the card or that's posted, and then you can just say how many tickets you want.
Yep.
And going off also with the patron dinner, so you pay the extra cost because you get a dinner. And since the setting is placed in India, they are having Indian food.
Oh, okay.
And also you get special seats, so that you get up close seats. So that's another reason to pay for the extra patron dinner.
Excellent. Yeah. So tickets are available now, and we have a link on our webpage for more information about it. It is called A Little Princess, and this is not the whole cast, right? I mean, how many are involved total? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh,
but.
Well, our whole cast consists of 52.
Wow.
25 crew members. I apologize. And most of it consists of 7th and 8th junior high girls, which has been an interesting but also challenging experience.
Well, that was the other thing that I was going to ask because, obviously at Heritage Christian, you've got all age levels. So is this primarily high school students on stage? But, What's the breakdown?
Yes, we have primarily high school students. Like Felicia was saying, we have a lot of junior high because they just came into the high school level.
Yeah.
We don't have that many in high school, so it kind of put us at a disadvantage.
Yeah. Well, that was the other question, is with a fairly large cast, is that kind of the entire student body? Is just about everybody involved in this?
Yes, about everybody, yeah. And we have a lot of roles that people have to switch their characters and do another role as well just to make it work.
But. Yeah. So this is something that I think is really cool that the vast majority, anyway, of the student body actually becomes involved in this in one way, shape, or form. As we said, we've got a link up for more information about the show and how you get tickets, A Little Princess, tomorrow and Saturday at Heritage Christian. And guys, thanks very much, all of you, for dropping by. I don't remember all the names, but we appreciate you coming in. Again, we've got it linked up at our webpage. Best of luck on the show. And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, roughly two-thirds of outstanding student loans in this country are currently delinquent or in default. What those borrowers need to know right now about the Trump administration's decision to accelerate collection efforts. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.